Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I'm the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference featured top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, Sean Reardon discusses Sarah Reber's paper, The History and Legacy of Title I. Reardon is a professor of education and sociology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Interdisciplinary Doctoral Training Program in Quantitative Education Policy Analysis.
Thanks, Sarah. I always like reading Sarah's papers and listening to her because I learn a lot. And I would also recommend to you the paper, the desegregation paper she mentioned, the Brown debusing paper, which is, I think, a really nice paper about the power of the federal role in changing some features of education. And so what I wanted to do, if I can find my slides here, is talk a little bit about, sort of pick up sort of where Sarah left off in thinking about the role of the federal government in inequality of education, but particularly I wanted to show a little bit of data on the trends in educational outcome inequality over time, because part of what Sarah and her colleagues have done really well is sort of show us some of the trends in how ESEA, Title I, affected sort of inputs and affected school context in terms of desegregation. And I want now to sort of try to say, what does this tell us about the federal role in affecting sort of student outcomes, and particularly inequality in student outcomes? And so I'll show you a few pictures here. So this is, you asked me to be upbeat, but this is going to be kind of downbeat. So these are the trends. The black lines are the trends in the achievement gap by income, the difference in average test scores between kids from the 90th and 10th percentile of the income distribution. And the blue and the red lines are the racial achievement gaps over time, the black, white, and Hispanic, white achievement gaps. So the good news here, of course, is that the racial achievement gaps are actually dramatically lower now than they were in the 1960s and 1970s, with a lot of that progress happening sort of in the early era, but evidence of sort of a new progress happening in the last two decades. The bad news is that the achievement gap by income, after being sort of flat through the 60s and 70s, sort of started to grow substantially in the 80s and grew a lot in the last few decades. I'll talk a little bit more about maybe this is good news right here that we can think about. But so let's think about what the federal role in this might be. So here's the black-white achievement gap. The dark line is data from the long-term trend NAEP, and it's probably it's a consistent test over time. The other lines are this black-white gap just measured with different data sources, from main NAEP, from state accountability tests, and from state NAEP, which is main NAEP. You know, these are averages within states. But whichever source we use, the story is basically the same. In the last few decades, the black-white achievement gap has narrowed significantly. Not, it's certainly still quite big, more, you know, 3/4 of a standard deviation or something, but it's gone down by maybe a fifth of a standard deviation or so over the last few decades. Now, we could think about sort of two interesting eras of federal policy in education. One is the era that Sarah was talking about, the ESEA and the start of Title I, and so I've shown that here. This sort of region here is kind of the period when kids were born who experienced some of their schooling before Title I and some of their schooling under Title I. And then this era is sort of Title I is in effect for all through kids' schooling. And then this is the same thing for the NCLB era. So kids born in the late 80s get to eighth grade just in time for like 1 year of NCLB maybe or something, and kids born in 97 or so are in kindergarten when NCLB starts. So after this line, you know, it's just all NCLB all the time, and this is the middle era. So you might think of sort of the Title I intervention really being largely a a federal role in providing more funding, as Sarah shows, more funding increases. And you might think of NCOB as being the federal role in increasing regulations without increasing funding, right? The unfunded mandate sort of story. So there's sort of different kinds of federal interventions. The initial Title I is a substantial amount of extra money from the federal government without a huge number of requirements, though the requirements grow over time. And NCOB is no new money, but a lot of new requirements. But a particular kind of requirement written into the legislation that says you have to pay attention to achievement gaps. You have to pay attention to inequality in educational outcomes, not just average scores. And so the hope, of course, was that NCOB will narrow achievement gaps while raising achievement for everyone by forcing schools and districts and states to focus on achievement by subgroup. And so this looks, I think, like it might be good news for the federal role, right? The black-white gaps start to narrow around the time, I mean, this is a lot of hand-waving here, around the time that NCLB starts. And so maybe that's because of NCLB. So, but if we look at one new piece of data, so in the last decade, we have three studies that provide nationally representative tests of kindergartners' school readiness, test scores in math and reading at the times kids enter kindergarten. And so by comparing the size of the gaps when kids enter kindergarten, we can see what's that black-white gap been doing over time. And it's been narrowing over this time period about the same rate as the gap in grades 3 to 8 has been narrowing. Now, we can't thank NCLB for narrowing the kindergarten achievement gap because kids haven't experienced any NCLB intervention when they get to kindergarten. And so what this suggests is that the progress we've made in the black-white gap in the last decade or two probably can't be attributed to NCLB because it's happening before kids get to kindergarten, and the amount that it grows between kindergarten and these are sort of estimated at age at grade 4, basically. So the amount that the black-white grows between kindergarten and grade 4 has been pretty stable over that time period. So if NCLB were working, we would hope that, you know, this trend would be going down a lot faster than this trend would be going down, but that's not what it looks like. So whatever is the cause of this good news, it doesn't suggest, well, you know, it's at a very high level that it's a sort of NCLB federal kind of a story. Now let's look at the same thing for the income gap. So this is the income gap over time. And again, of course, it's going up here in the NCLB era. And maybe, I don't know, if you were trying to be optimistic, you might say, well, look, Title I looks like it slowed down the increase of the gap. But I wouldn't put much stock in this early trend. It's based on some pretty lousy data from 1960. And so I would believe the trend, you know, in this era, but that very early period is not particularly great data. So we don't know much about what Title I did, but it certainly doesn't look like it made it get smaller because it started to get bigger. But it didn't get bigger when Title I started, it got bigger starting later. So it's probably sort of unconnected largely. But what happened in the more recent era? Well, if we look at the kindergarten gaps for the same three cohorts of kids, the good news is the gap in kindergarten school readiness by income seems to have been going down over the last decade, in contrast to what the gap has been doing for the sort of 25 years prior. Now, it's a little bit unclear when we didn't have this piece of data, this last dot, we just got those data a few months ago, and so if you ever saw me show this picture before, I never had that last dot, and the line didn't sort of bend down like that, and so it just looked unremittingly bad. And now maybe it's good, but maybe this is just one noisy piece of data. I wouldn't sort of hang your hopes on one dot on this picture. There's a lot of dots going up and this sort of one here, but maybe it's good news. I think we need to wait a little while, sadly, to know what the real trend is. But in any case, we see these gaps going down in this recent era. What the cause of that is, again, probably isn't due to anything in K-12 education because the gaps are going down when kids get to kindergarten. So it's got something to do with things happening before the time kids get to school. And that may be increased access to high-quality preschool and childcare for lower and middle-income kids, for example, but it wouldn't be a... You'd be hard-pressed to tell a kind of K-12 policy story that would explain that. Next thing I wanted to look at was the trends in the high school graduation rate. So this is data from Dick Murnane's recent paper where he assembles... he uses Heckman and LaFontaine's data and then adds more recent data to it. This, in contrast to, I think, what Sarah showed, I think yours probably included GED recipients. Murnane doesn't. So these are lower rates than you show in a slightly different trend. But the Murnane story is basically that the high school graduation rates have been pretty flat over time. There's been some, maybe a very slow narrowing over time for a while. But in the last two decades, there's been a kind of a not only an increase in graduation rates overall, but most of that increase is driven by blacks and Hispanic rates increasing. And so the gap, high school graduation rates now, is about half the size of what it was four decades ago. And so that's good news. Does that coincide with NCLB or anything? Well, this 1984 is when the cohort who graduated in 2002 would have been born. So these kids didn't experience NCLB, and these kids maybe got a few years of high school in NCLB. So it's hard to attribute this narrowing to anything about NCLB. Of course, we have to wait a while to see if 20 to 24-year-olds graduate, so we can't tell for the more recent cohorts what the outcomes are. This is data that I got from a Child Trends report, but on attainment by race. And we don't see, there's obviously big racial gaps here. And the racial gaps, particularly the Hispanic-white gap, but to some extent the black-white gap, actually grow after Title I kind of come in place. So that again, is not good news for any crude story you might tell about the role of the federal government. So all of that suggests to me that there's no sort of prima facie kind of evidence that suggests that that either Title I or NCLB made any large-scale improvements in racial or economic disparities and outcomes, despite the fact that they made some substantial changes in funding and in desegregation. Now, part of the reason for that might be, as Sarah points out, is that even though there's a big increase in federal funding, the federal role has always been tiny, essentially, in education. For a long time, federal funding accounted for about 7% of all education spending in the U.S. I think maybe it's now up to 10% or something like that. But it's still a small amount. So even a big increase in funding doesn't change the amount of dollars most schools have available. It does. What has changed more recently, of course, is the requirements attached to it. I'll just sort of end by giving you a quick snapshot of this paper that we've been working on, looking to see if NCLB narrowed achievement gaps in a more nuanced way than I've just showed you here. And so first, if we just look on average within states at what achievement gaps have been doing over time, these are the black-white achievement gaps, they've been going down, as I showed you before. NCLB starts here in 2002. I forgot to draw my line. But the trend was there before NCLB starts. In fact, it's even a little steeper here before NCLB starts. So it doesn't look like there's a sort of dramatic change in the trend. What we then do is we look in every state and we say, for each cohort of kids, the more years that they were exposed to NCLB by a particular grade, do we see any evidence that that's associated with smaller gaps? So for cohorts who were in NCLB from kindergarten all the way through eighth grade, do they have smaller gaps than a prior cohort who only had it from fourth grade through eighth grade or something like that? And so we leverage sort of variation across cohorts and across grades to look and see if there's some sort of a change in the size of the gap associated with the amount of time a cohort's been exposed to NCLB. And we find that on average, zero, but variation across states. Some states, there actually is an association. Other states, there's, in fact, a negative association. And here's, this is same story for Hispanics, but here's the interesting finding, I think. So on the y-axis is the sort of estimated annual NCLB effect. And so you can think of this as the amount that the achievement gap changes for every year a cohort is exposed to NCLB, every year that they're in school while NCLB is in effect. And so you know, 0.002 is a small number, but that's every year. So if you had NCOB exposure for 9 years from kindergarten through eighth grade, that would add up to be 0.18 standard deviations, which would not be a trivial effect. We would be happy if we could do that, I think. And you can see that, you know, the effects are sort of scattered around zero. There's a bunch of states where it's around 0.01, but a bunch of states where it's actually going the wrong direction. But what we then do is we say NCOB put a lot more pressure on schools in some states than other states for reasons that had to do with NCOB's design. So NCOB says you have to report and you're held accountable for your students' test scores by subgroup as long as there's enough students in that subgroup in your school and in a grade or in your school to yield a statistically reliable number. Now, how many do you need to have for statistical reliability? That varies across states. The laws of statistics are not the same in every state. So in some states, you only need 20, and in California, you need 100 for reliability. We have much noisier data, apparently, than everywhere else. But so both because of states setting this laws of statistics interpretation in different places, but largely, actually, because of differences in the amount of segregation and the racial composition of states, the number of black students, say, in a state who are in a school where there's enough black students that their scores are reported varies dramatically across states. So if you're in Louisiana, lots of black students, very highly segregated. Almost every black student in Louisiana is in a school with at least 40 other black students, and so there's enough that the state reports their test scores, and therefore most black students are in a school where the school is supposed to pay attention to their test scores. If you go to Vermont, there's not very many black students. Those that are there are not very segregated. And literally zero black students in Vermont are in a school where there's enough black students that their scores are reported. And so there's no pressure in Vermont due to this feature of NCOB to compel schools and districts to sort of pay attention specifically to the achievement of their black students. And so we hypothesize, well, if NCOB works, if this sort of accountability regime narrows achievement gaps, it ought to do so mostly in places where most of the minority students are in a school where their scores sort of count, and it ought to do so less so in the Vermont. So Louisiana ought to see bigger effects of NCOB than Vermont. This is Louisiana, that's Vermont. And so, in fact, we find this slope is statistically significant. There is a bigger narrowing of the gap in the states where more of the black students are in schools where they're accountable. So we find the same thing, though it's a much noisier pattern for Hispanics for a variety of reasons. But again, we find the same basic slope. Now, I don't know if it's, you know, that's enough good news to leave you with, but it's the one sort of piece of good news I could find in this data that suggests that the federal education policy might play some role in narrowing achievement inequalities. So I'll leave you with that.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The Center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the Center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.